Everyone's asleep.
Welcome in, folks. We are live with Vinny Eastwood from the Vinny Eastwood Show. Vinny, are you there?
I am indeed.
This is good to hear. This is a live simulcast on live365.com. And it is a unique thing for the In Wish Out Show because we haven't done this with anyone before, especially Vinny. So welcome aboard, Vinny. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, you know, it's a bit of a simulcast, so as well as welcoming you, ladies and gentlemen, to the Ian Wishart Show, we're also welcoming you to the Vinny Eastwood Show. This suddenly feels really right to me. I was actually just arguing with a whole bunch of people from the Kiwi Journalists Association, Ian, and they're all like really arrogant and like abusive and things like this. Anybody talks about anything to do with world government conspiracy or the climate change hoax or anything really that's real, you get abused for. And I was like, these are the people that are calling themselves journalists. And somebody asked me, what is the pinnacle? What are you actually really trying to do in terms of journalism? And I thought to myself, you know, I guess the idea should be to balance credibility and morality. And I couldn't think of any person who personifies more than that, not in this country, in the New Zealand field, than yourself, Ian.
That's very kind of you, Vinny. Yeah, it's a big issue, I think, for journalism, basically. I'm not sure that we have our game quite right yet as a profession.
Although you could be would be surprised that a lot of people within the profession certainly don't agree with you.
Yeah, well, I think the problem is this. I think that journalism has turned from a profession which it used to be into being an agenda-driven profession that sees itself as part of the establishment, virtually the marketing arm of the establishment, and the movement between journalism and PR these days is so wide that this sort of is an illustration, I think, of the problem that we face, because journalists are moving back and forth from news to PR, politics, left, right, and centre. Just look at the Shane Taurima controversy. Here he was standing for Labor, or trying to stand for Labor, didn't make it, went back to news, ends up running Labor Party political meetings from within TVNZ's building. They should have seen that one coming.
Well, and also there's MediaWorks. What was his name? Stephen Joyce was CEO of MediaWorks, and then he becomes the government communication minister and then brokers, like, what was it, a $30 or $40 million bailout in unpaid broadcasting fees that MediaWorks couldn't afford because the advertisers can't be bothered advertising with them because nobody watches them because they suck. All right, that's my interpretation. I could be wrong.
Yeah, the cynic in you. I mean, look, I think the problem with my fellow journalist is this. They see themselves as evangelists for various ideas and theories, and they go out there and they print this stuff unquestioningly. You look at their stand on vaccination, on fluoride, on food additives, a range of things that the media should be far more questioning about. and they're just not.
Incidentally, one of them objected to me posting a video of Dr. Laurie Brett, who's a fairly well-known dentist in this country up in Whangarei, who's got amazing credibility when it comes to questioning the science behind fluoride, or the lack thereof. And what one of these journalists criticized me for is putting up his version, Dr. Laurie's version, and not counterbalancing it with the mainstream version. My perspective was that if you're going to be covering something that the mainstream isn't, cover that, because all of the rest of it's done. Okay, if people want to be propagandized about the false benefits of fluoride, we have the Ministry of Health cracking down on everybody, we have the media in everybody's back pockets. They don't need any help propagating their propaganda. The people speaking out against it, on the other hand, those are the only people that I'm interested in helping. Otherwise, what's the point, Ian?
Well, that's one of the criticisms that I've always faced from my colleagues in the media, because Investigate magazine has done some pithy stories over the years, and we're accused of being one-sided in terms of politics. But I've said to them, look, I'm playing a long game here, because if you go back to the 1990s and the Winebox investigation, the Paradise Conspiracy, that sort of thing, National was in power, and they got a bollocking from Investigate magazine. Labor came into power after that, and that was the era of Investigate, and they got a bollocking from Investigate magazine. National are back in power, and we have criticised them on a number of fronts and have certainly not been fulsome in support. The Daylight Robbery book featuring John Key on the front cover is just an example of, questioning again the wisdom of asset sales. We are there to question whoever is in power without fear or favour. And I think that's what my colleagues in the media forget. They become wedded to the politics, as in Shane Tyrima again. They wear their political colours on their sleeves, and they forget that they're journalists first and foremost, rather than evangelists for whatever political belief that they hold. And this is where our profession is running aground, because a lot of the journalists who are in practice don't disclose their political beliefs, but their political beliefs govern how they write their stories. And that's a problem, because the public see no transparency.
It's editorializing under the guise of journalism, isn't it, to a large extent?
That's exactly right, yeah.
Well, this inherently, to me, is a conflict of interest, I think, and also there's the element of can you run a successful journalism business in this country? Can you actually make enough money to survive based purely on reporting the truth? Now, if you want to make large quantities of money, I'm not sure if that's entirely possible. You can't become a multimillionaire by only telling the truth, because ultimately many of the power brokers in this country and many others who are holding much of the finances and at bay and what have you are the ones who are more likely to be advertising on television and what have you, and certainly would withdraw their funding if their business interests were threatened by a little something called the truth.
Yeah, this is right, and I think we are a testimony to exactly this problem. If you look at Investigate magazine, when it started off, we had more readers than Metro magazine currently has. We had absolutely no advertising agency support because we were seen as politically incorrect. They didn't like our flavour of the truth. So although we're a glossy magazine with a big readership, we did not get supported. It was just actively discouraged. When the Labor government was in power, they made sure that their advertising agency handed out contracts to all the media who were favourable, and none of the media who had ever criticised Labor got advertising contracts for various government agencies that were doing big ad campaigns through the 2000s. So we certainly weren't making money from advertising. That meant that we as a magazine had to rely entirely on our readership and subscriber base to make money. And you don't become a millionaire off that. And then you get people who say, oh, well, all the hard work you're doing, you work for 6 months or 12 months on an investigation, and quite frankly, you should give it out for free because we think we deserve to hear it for free. And there's this mentality within the public. So you're caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, really, because the people with the money, the power brokers, won't pay you. And the public are not willing to pay for investigative journalism in some cases. So where do you go?
I noticed that problem myself, and what I did is I tried to find a target market. My target market is people who have woken up to the truth about the world government, how more or less most of what we're raised to believe isn't true, and the people who have fallen into that without a catch net. Psychologically speaking, it's actually incredibly traumatic to have your current view of reality warped, as it were, to the point where you almost don't believe anything the establishment says anymore. Your whole life falls apart. That's my target audience, those people who are in that state of trauma, who want to have a few laughs and be able to survive. That's basically it. And I find if I do it for them for free, they appreciate it and watch it. And if I ask for donations, they give them to me when I need them, and only as much as I need. That's what I found very interesting. It doesn't matter how much I ask for, I'll only get exactly enough to pay the bills. Which to me is quite synchronistic in a way. I recall one morning I was waking up stressed because I had my rent due, my car needed to be fixed, and you know, all of these other general expenses that people with a 9-to-5 regular paycheck and what have you are a bit of a pain. But for somebody who doesn't have that regular income, it can be actually incredibly stressful to live under. And I calculated it in my head while I was walking from my bedroom to my computer to start work, and I said I needed about $500. So I went to my PayPal, and there was an exact $500 donation sitting in there by one of my listeners. You know, I think it's when you're doing the right thing, the universe shows up to support you in some way. Maybe it's a divinity. I'm not 100% sure. All I know is that I'm grateful both to my listeners and for the fact that I get to do the right thing and I don't hurt people in the way that I make money.
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly working towards a model. I mean, with Investigate magazine, of course, we do the magazine. We have the book publishing company. We've branched out, as listeners to the show now know, into radio on live365.com. And that's different ways of reaching people. I guess, you know, like you, we too find that we have enough to pay the bills and you know, we have enough to market our products. We're certainly not, you know, made of money. We live an average lifestyle and work very hard. But I think for me, the real issue is the passion behind the work, because I'm not doing it to become a millionaire. And I guess that was the other part of my story.
Yeah.
I could have easily changed the way that I covered things in order to become more commercial. Could have done that with a snap of the fingers, just like that. And I would have made a fortune, but it would have sold my soul.
Is that really what we're talking about here, is that those journalists who don't make that choice to become independent and to report the truth, regardless of what it really cost them, are they actually selling their souls in and of itself to do that? And if so, how can they get them back once they've gone to that?
Look, I think it's wider than journalism.
Yeah.
If you read Totalitaria, the essence of that book is that we have been indoctrinated now for decades to effectively subconsciously be prepared for the coming world government regime. That world government regime has a number of commandments that it wants people to believe in. And those commandments are being taught in our school systems, in our universities, in social media conversations. People are just being indoctrinated left, right, and center. The journalists come through that education process the same as everybody else. The journalism courses are as guilty as everybody else of indoctrinating young journalists into these belief systems. They don't even know they're doing it. They can't even see that their worldview is corrupting their independence. So we now have a society that is effectively feeding on itself and breaking down. We're losing the ability to think critically. We're losing the ability to have a sensible debate. And this is one of the things that we're trying to provoke with, you know, everything that we're doing.
You know, it's interesting you should use the word provoke, because that's actually what I feel like doing a lot of the times. I mean, I've never been trained in journalism. I've never actually worked in the industry, although I have spoken to many people within it, people who have left it and that kind of thing. And I recall something you told me, I think it might have been even a couple of years ago when I was first starting my show, Ian, that you thought that the, what was it, TVNZ blondes, you said, or that the journalists or airheads, it just occurred to me that you don't actually need to be that bright in this society in order to be respected. You don't even need to be respectful of your readership. In fact, one of the I think it was Diana Clement, I think. I'm not sure if you've heard of her, but she's one of the admins of that Kiwi Journalists Association. And she told me in a message as she was trying to vet me to come into this group in the first place that this group was not for the great unwashed. Now, just that term, the great unwashed, it just smacked to me like she thought she was better than everybody else. And sure enough, when going into the group, the attitude of the other journalists as well seemed to do that. And it occurs to me that this is how the hierarchy actually works. If you get a whole bunch of people in together who think they're better than everybody else, they think it's perfectly justified, even in the face of massive hypocrisy, to act terribly to other people. It reminds me of the the Harvard jailing study, I think, where they dressed up students as prisoners and students as guards. And after a very short period of time, because the students who were the prisoners had no power whatsoever, they started getting abused and taken advantage of by those with the power. And I think that's how this society is kind of running, like champagne glass pyramids, really.
Well, if you look at the book Totalitaria again, the book documents a secret society that wants to control the planet and control politics and control a whole bunch of things. And they've been very successful at doing it, and the book lays out exactly what they've got away with. And they too have this attitude that there's a difference between the great unwashed, the general public as we know them, and the initiates. The initiates, the experts, the top of the tree, will know everything, but the great unwashed will know nothing, be led carefully and calmly by the nose and directed to believe in certain things, but we can't expect too much of them because they're basically ignorant. And this is in the book, the phrasing of these documents, that the contempt with which they hold the ordinary people. And they say they have little minds and they can't really know much at all. Therefore, we shouldn't stress them with the details. We'll just take control. And that's what they proceeded to do. I mean, our schooling system, as I said, our schooling system, our social services, they've all been tainted by this stuff. And so we're seeing effectively, Mogadon-type people popping up everywhere.
Sorry, you might have to define...
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
You might have to define Mogadon for me.
Mogadon, yeah, who remembers Mogadon? Invasion of the Body Snatchers, it's like the soul is missing from these people. Their minds are just, they've lost the ability to think for themselves. They just follow whatever mantra they've been given to hum.
That sounds actually like I've interviewed a Freemason whistleblower. In fact, I was speaking with him just this evening, in fact, and he was telling me about how all of these degrees and things that they're trying to lead people into is more or less very slowly ripening the initiate's soul up for demon possession. And I think, you look at some of these people in our society who do these terrible things, and I don't think they're really human. There's something human missing from them. And I'm talking about the elite specifically, the very, very high up people. Something's been lost in their humanity and can't return.
This is something that, again, I'm going to labour the point because it's a really important point. The book Totalitaria has documented this issue of who wants to take over the planet. And just to put this in context, there's been plenty of attempts to rule the world over the centuries, as we all know. But the technical ability to do that has only existed in the present day. Previous attempts were done by brute force or conquest, And quite frankly, no matter how hard the Romans tried, they couldn't really administer the entire planet, and they didn't. At their peak, they only covered 4% of the globe. The Nazis covered 4% of the globe at their peak. The two biggest empires the world has seen were the Mongols, who, of course, had lots of land to play with, and they covered 21% of the planet, and the British Empire, which covered 24% at its peak. But even the British, where the sun never set on empire, could not avoid the issue of, well, you can't really control New Zealand in real time from London. Today, with the technology that we now have, that's changed.
So I think the point of totalitarian to stress to those who will be readership, and if you're listening to this and you're not planning on reading the book, heaven help you, but the point here is, if you want to fight for liberty, if you actually want freedom, this isn't just your chance, this is your last chance. Once the system is in, once it is locked in, it will be irresistible, like Tina Turner.
Exactly, or Robert Palmer, or whatever it is that sings that song. Look, it is very much like that. Now, I think totalitarian, you know, for all of the people who hate Ian Wishart as a brand, they need to get off their moral high horse and read the book, because the issue is, you know, this is a real plan to take over the world. And the issue I've got with that is that I'm just getting interruptions outside the window. There's a bunch of cows. The neighbor's cows have invaded the driveway. Well, I sound distracted, that's why. Reading the dailies.
I can rant for a few minutes, Ian, if you want to go check on them, though.
I'll go chase them. Look, I'll play some music. I can see them heading for getting into all sorts of damage. Anyway, I'll be back in just a moment.
Okay. Right. Well, I think as Ian was kind of trying to say, is that the book Totalitarian is, at least the parts that I've read of it, I haven't managed to read through the entire thing. I'm not much of a reader, I'm sorry, but the point here is, as I said, it's simply irresistible, and I think what you have to realize, and I don't want to condescend or tell you anything that you don't know, you're probably my elders and wiser than I am. I've looked at the demographics for these kind of shows, and everybody tends to be twice my age, usually far more qualified than I have and more life experience. However, because all of those kind of people are my friends and listeners, I've accumulated their knowledge without earning it. So let me just proceed. The life that you think that you've been living your entire existence, oh man, I'm feeling it sounding really arrogant here, isn't what you think it is, okay? And the people who you may have ever looked up to, those people who you put on a pedestal, will disappoint you. This is the way the system has been set up, so that those who you love, honor, try to be part of and what have you, are actually involved usually in a scheme themselves, if not by their own volition, by their brainwashing. How do you know if you're brainwashed? If you never question whether or not you're being brainwashed. Okay? That's simple. And one of my listeners today sent me a message hurriedly. He was very freaked out. He works for the tax department. And he was concerned, and I think this is actually a good lesson for all of us, he was concerned that because he saw scumbaggery happening all around him, and it's been happening for so long, he used to talk about it, he used to try and bring issue with it, and keep getting shouted down, and now what's happening is when he sees the scumbaggery around him, he doesn't mind so much, and he had a crisis of conscience, and he was like, oh my God, I don't actually mind the scumbaggery anymore. Am I a scumbag? And I said to him, no, you're not. Because if you were a scumbag, it would never occur to you, oh my God, I'm a scumbag. The same way it would never occur to somebody who was brainwashed, oh my God, I'm brainwashed. Because as soon as you make the realization, the second you make it, the brainwashing and all those conditionings and everything come off. It is just as important to expose the scumbaggery within yourself as it is to expose the scumbaggery within the government or the media or any of these other X amount of institutions which are all inexorably controlled by the same group of sociopathic scumbaggery that control the whole planet. Anyway, my question to you, the listeners, and I want you to think about this. Are you doing enough? No, seriously. Think about this for a moment. Think about it long and hard and honestly. Are you doing enough to prevent the spread of scumbaggery? Scumbaggery is all-encompassing, sure, but we're all putting up with it to an extent, aren't we? We're all compromised. I'm still paying rent. I'm still paying power bills. You all are. There's no way out of this system. They've got us by the short and curlies.
They've grabbed you by your scumbag. That's what they've done.
Yeah. And the and my question to the audience is, are they doing enough? And if you lose that self-analysis, am I doing enough? Have I become a scumbag unwittingly? Am I brainwashed? Those kind of self-analysis is incredibly important for your longevity if you are actually going to oppose these kind of forces by which assail us.
Yeah, well, if I can go back to the issue of totalitarian, the plan for world government, after being distracted by the Frisians. The book basically sets out this, that in the 1870s, a group, a secret society, believing that they had a divine mission, set out a plan to seize control of the future of the world. They infiltrated Buddhism. They set up the New Age movement. They infiltrated the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church. They infiltrated the United Nations. All of this is documented. It's covered in UN documentation. It's covered in autobiographies, some books long out of print. But they had a very clear plan, a very clear agenda. And the issue with that is these people believe they are supernaturally governed. And the world government that they want to impose is going to have that flavor. So if you think life is interesting now, it's going to get a hell of a lot more interesting if this happens.
I found this funny because a few people have used that word interesting in this context, and by interesting they mean totally messed up, bro.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, you people would get up in arms if they thought that there was going to be a born-again fundamentalist Christian administration running the country, let alone the world.
They've gotten up in arms just at the mention that one's trying to run for parliament.
Exactly. This is the thing. And yet, if you go to the other extreme, there's a mad bunch of New Age sympathisers who seriously think that they can usher in the return of the coming one, the absolute supreme, if they raise planetary vibrations enough. And they've seized on climate change and world governance as the way to do this. And it's just bizarre. But the problem is that we're not talking about fringe people here. We're talking about Secretaries General of the United Nations. These are people who are seriously in control of the planet. They have massive budgets to work with. And they've got a lot of the politicians of the world on side.
Well, I think the closest any of these people are going to come to the Supreme is when they go to Pizza Hut for dinner tonight.
Yeah, well, again, the point I make in the book is this. You don't have to believe in the religious supernatural stuff that these people believe in. It doesn't actually matter what you believe if you read totalitarian. You can be an atheist, you can be a skeptic, you can be a whatever. The point is this. The people who are in power and who have this agenda believe this. And that makes them very dangerous.
That's true. I mean, think what you will of Muslim extremism. And the false terrorism kind of aspects that are coming out of it, and just basically being as an excuse to surveil everybody. It doesn't matter whether or not you believe in Muslim extremism. What matters is whether or not they are willing to blow you up. Okay.
Yeah. This is exactly right. And in fact, in the book, I quote some documents. These people who have this agenda that I'm talking about, the world government agenda. Their belief is that they can only unite humanity and institute the brotherhood of man and world government if they create a new world religion. They see Christians, Muslims, and Jews as problematic to that. And so they're doing everything they can to stir up trouble between those three religions, particularly Christianity and Islam, with the idea that if they stir up fundamentalists at either extreme, then the population of the world will come to hate Christians and Muslims generally, which will make the job of the world government people even easier because it gives them another manufactured crisis to solve. It's just divide and rule. And the public need to wake up to that.
I had a realization the other day. In fact, this is when I was smoking. I was like, oh, my God. There's like a couple of the most discriminated against peoples nowadays. It used to be people were discriminated against by race or sexuality and what have you. But now that's not really happening at all. Racism's kind of on its way out. Gay marriage has been legalized. You know, anybody says anything like that in public, you get chastised more or less. But if you're a smoker, you get cast out like a leper. If you're a conspiracy theorist, people back away very, very slowly from you.
And, oh, yeah, but if you're a conspiracy factualist, they stay and listen.
Allegedly. You know, I've tried to lay facts on people, but they argue that there's no such thing as facts. And I think this is another part of the genius of this new world religion is solipsism. Nothing exists except me. Everything that I see around me, everything that I see, taste, touch, or smell is my own mind's creation, and I am responsible for all of it. All right? Yeah. My consciousness governs the entire world and voids the other 7 billion people's consciousness. How freaking insane is that?
That's bizarre. But again, this is symptomatic of the problem that we have. This is why this new religion is going to appeal to the public, because it has no judgment. It demands nothing of its followers except blind obedience to political correctness. And it makes everyone sing from the same hymn sheet. That's the way the world government people see it. They see religion as the ultimate opiate of the masses and the way of controlling the masses. You know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners are divided on the issue of climate change. I can tell you, having researched the scientific papers, and I labour this point time and time again, the scientific evidence on climate change is very mixed. There is a huge debate taking place behind the scenes on whether you can even detect any human influence on climate at all at the moment. The planet's been cooling down for the last 10, 12 years, and our CO2 emissions have been increasing at a rate of knots over that time, so there's no direct correlation between CO2 and planetary temperatures. However, climate change was decided on as a major issue back in the early 1970s by the World Governance Group, who said we need to create environmental concerns that will unite the people behind it and give us a reason to impose new legislation and new laws effectively to save the planet, but with the mechanism of creating this world governance structure. This has been on the agenda for at least 40 years.
You're and talking the about the Club of Rome documents.
The Club of Rome documents, the environment conference at Stockholm, all of these things
the Rio
are
Summit.
Mechanisms yeah. of the same outfit. And look, you know, if without giving the game away, the Totalitarian book outlines this in absolute gory detail, but the point that I'm making, and this is directly related to your comment a second ago, is about facts. There are a million people out there who are listening to this saying, wish out just another conspiracy theory. There are 500 footnotes in that book referenced back to UN documents, New Zealand government documents, American government documents, autobiographies written by the officials and the people involved. I have gone to the nth degree to nail down every alleged conspiracy theory and turn it into a conspiracy fact. It's not really conspiracy, because a conspiracy is something that takes place hidden. This agenda is hidden in plain sight. It's always been there if you're smart enough to know where to find it. Sadly, most people have been indoctrinated to not recognize it. I was reminded, I was speaking at a function last night, and I use this anecdote. Many of you will have watched the TV series The Following, and TVNZ ran a promo for that a couple of weeks ago. And the promo tagline from the show itself said this: "The smartest thing the devil ever did was convince the world he didn't exist." And by blinding the population to a sector that actually is trying desperately to control them. It's almost like the Star Wars movie. These are not the droids you're looking for. It's old Obi-Wan's mind control tricks are underway here. The public, the media, they are blind to what is coming towards them. People who've read Totalitaria are waking up big time. It's like taking the red pill in the Matrix and finding out what's going on behind down the rabbit hole. It really is like that. And that's the reaction I'm getting. I mean, we had a big interview on George Norrie's show, Coast to Coast AM, just before Christmas. And, you know, he puts both of us to shame. 4 million listeners simultaneously to that show.
Actually, it's he's got between 19 and 29 million listeners, give or take about 400 to 500 affiliates. He's the number two talk radio show host in America, just beyond Rush Limbaugh, who's number one. He's number two. So
And it's staggering, and the impact of that, I think, is that Americans I've read more about Totalitaria than New Zealanders have. But the book is there, and as all the reviews are coming in and saying is, well, you know, regardless of whether it sounds all spooky, there's the documents. This is the agenda. It's there in plain sight. You can see what the Pope did in 1965. You can see what this crowd did. You can see what the Freemasons did. You can see what all these other secret societies got involved in and did right up to the present day. You can see what their agenda is, how they've written the education policies for New Zealand and America and Britain and Australia and Canada, specifically to condition the public to believe in their new regime. And this is a really, really dangerous thing. Totalitarian is a weapon for anybody who reads it, because it is like taking the red pill. It's like, wake up, smell the coffee. This is life-changing stuff for you. Now, naturally, the powers that be don't like me. But that's just, you know, goes with the territory, I guess.
Well, I also have this other thing, and I wanted to ask you if this has ever happened. I know that you're kind of like mature and well reserved and stuff like this, but every now and again, the denial and the brainwashing of other people and the abuse that they give me for trying to save their ass frustrates me so that I scream and I yell and I get really enraged and so on and so forth before eventually calming down again and going back to work. Has this happened to you?
Yeah, it is a frustrating process. It really is. You feel like bashing your head against the wall and just going, bleh, because you can't lead a horse to water and force it to drink. It is frustrating because the knowledge is there at their fingertips if they would only look and see. Sadly, a lot of people are so hung up on their own mentality, their own intellect, that they refuse to consider other arguments. Now, one of the things that I've been conscious of as a journalist is that I like to keep my friends close and my enemies closer, because I don't believe that I can do a decent job as an investigative journalist in actually uncovering and debating an issue in this story if I don't fully appreciate the argument that my opponents are making, regardless of how much I like them or not. And that means that, for example, when I did the book, The Divinity Code, on the existence of God, I read in depth all the books by Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and John Spong and Karen Armstrong and the like on their views about the existence of God and the evolution process and the origins of life and that sort of thing. I needed to know their arguments accurately so that I could then assess them, assemble the evidence that I felt showed their arguments were weak, and put it together in a book. If I'd just gone out there and written a book off the top of my head, paying no attention at all to the arguments that my opponents were raising, it would have been a very stupid thing to do. And yet so many people don't bother to research the facts or listen to the other side of the story before they express their opinion, particularly on issues like the ones we're talking about now. And, you know, that's a weakness. I think, you know, again, you go back to the Kahui book controversy from 2011, a Facebook campaign to ban the Maxina King book that I wrote. 8 weeks before the book was even finished and published, nobody knew what was in it. It turned out the book came out with a conclusion that the coroner then said, bang on, you're dead right. Everybody jumped on the bandwagon, issued an opinion about something they'd never read. It was staggering to me. They weren't even prepared to listen to the other side of the story, because they were all so holier than thou and thought that they'd got it all sussed and they'd made their minds up. They knew everything there was to know. Over the course of the weeks of that boycott campaign, I was able to point out to lots of them, your arguments are flawed. You're basing your arguments on old media reports that were out of date and wrong at the time they were published, because let's face it, journalists only have a limited amount of time to get the story right for a daily newspaper or a radio news broadcast. They don't have the time to go in depth. They're just relying on what a friend of a friend said often, especially when it comes down to police sources. And they don't do a great job. And I had reporters from the New Zealand Herald and Sunday Star Times and other papers writing to me after they read the Breaking Silence book, and they said, we covered the court case of Chris Kahui. We covered the inquest with Maxina King, and we think you did a fantastic job, much better than anything we could have possibly done. We missed a whole lot of leads that we should have picked up on. And that was my colleagues, my peers, telling me after the event that Breaking Silence was a worthwhile book, and they got something from it, and they'd covered the court cases. So again, I guess the point that I'm trying to make is it's really important, regardless of whether people disagree with you or I personally, forget about the person. Listen to the argument. Is the argument logically sound? Is it valid? Do the facts stack up? Do the facts support the conclusions being made? Sure, there's room for debate, but let's have an honest, realistic debate, not a hate session. If we stop listening to each other, we are lost as a society.
It's very similar to a marriage, I guess.
Yeah, it is. It is like that. And you know, again, going back through the great pantheon of books, the great divide on the story of New Zealand's treaty and how it came about was an educational process for me. Because we've read so many history books here in New Zealand, you know, Michael King and Claudia Orange and all the rest of them. History books written by scholars, usually getting government grants, and quite sizable government grants, I might add. And they filter the historical documents and information through their own perspectives and their own prejudices. And I'm not saying that to be mean. That's just what humans do, and particularly what historians and scholars do, because that's the expertise that they bring to it. They bring their own view of the world and their own view of their subject to the material. What I did with The Great Divide was to go back into the original source material, the diaries of Captain Cook and the others on the Endeavour, and the original writings of Samuel Marsden and Henry Williams and the early New Zealand settlers and missionaries and so forth. And I looked at what they wrote in terms of their first contact with Māori people. And remembering, of course, that although they were European and you can accuse them of being Eurocentric, racism wasn't an issue back then. As far as they were concerned, they were explorers exploring a foreign country and a foreign culture, and New Zealand was just another foreign culture in a long list of foreign cultures that they'd explored. And they were approaching it pretty much from an academic perspective, albeit, you know, one tainted by the social mores of the 1700s. But their accounts were not loaded with the political baggage that the treaty issue is now loaded with. None of that was yet in their gun sights. We have a startlingly honest account of early Māori life in this country. And to tell you the truth, The Great Divide is one of the few books you'll read where that account is actually published. Because when you read Michael King's book, The Penguin History of New Zealand, it's all sanitized out. It's not there. Michael King went and filtered all of this stuff and only gave the readers the stuff that suited his argument. Whereas I just went back to the historical documents for The Great Divide and published them. Plenty of quotes. People can see for themselves what was happening, why the Māori signed the treaty. You know, and getting back to the marriage point, the thing that I learned from that historical search is that Māori and Pākehā genuinely wanted a union of the races in 1840. And even as late as 1860, there was a huge hui at Kohimarama. 200 chiefs from around the country gathered for it. It was bigger even than the Waitangi treaty signing. And almost to a man, the chiefs all ratified the coming of the British at 1840, the relinquishing of Māori sovereignty. And believe me, they saw it as the relinquishing of sovereignty. They knew they'd given away their sovereignty. They were happy to have done so because for them, there'd been a huge number of benefits in the intervening 20 years. You don't hear that story today. That story has been sanitised out of the history books. You almost cannot find a New Zealand history book that mentions the hui at Koyamarama. So I quoted it chapter and verse in The Great Divide, because it showed that there was a real willingness to be a united country back in 1840 and 1860. And we've lost that to an extent now. If we could only learn from our ancestors and learn to talk better and to understand what we each need, then we get along better. I guess that's my point. You know, it doesn't matter what political leaning you come from. I enjoy a good debate, and I hope that people who listen to us can enjoy a good debate.
I concur with that. In fact, the kind of debates that I like the most is when the person I'm debating is correct and I'm wrong, because I get to learn something. And I believe that this is actually an ironic kind of kind of thing for a conspiracy theorist to have, to love being proved wrong. It's just because I don't believe that I'm done learning yet. I'm still young, and quite frankly, my ideas of the world change on a regular basis, and my beliefs are constantly changing. I mean, 2013 Vinny is different from 2014 Vinny. Heck, January Vinny is different from February Vinny. I don't know who I'm going to be tomorrow.
It's called following where the evidence leads, and it's something that I think everyone should do. If somebody came along tomorrow and made an outstanding case for human-caused climate change and published the scientific information which was convincing over and above the information that says it's not human-caused, I would change my opinion on climate change, because to otherwise would be to deny reality.
Yes.
But I haven't seen that evidence. I'm prepared to change my mind if someone convinces me, likewise, on the existence of God. I didn't choose Christianity for a feel-good factor by becoming a Christian. I chose Christianity because I'd begun as an atheist. I'd gnashed my teeth and wailed against that. I eventually came to the conclusion I can't deny the existence of a creator, because there's no other rational explanation for the world, unless you go down fairy tale theories like multiple universes, which we can't ever prove scientifically. Which is just another, effectively, a religious belief as well, but it's just one that renames God and calls him a multiverse instead of God. So I made a decision for Christianity on an intellectual basis, and the spiritual stuff followed. But if someone was to make a compelling case that Christianity was untrue, in other words, you know, they dug up the body of Jesus somewhere and he hadn't been resurrected, of course I'd have to change my mind. It would only be rational to do so. I don't expect that to happen, because it hasn't happened yet. And there's plenty of good evidence that he was resurrected. But, you know, the point that I'm making is we should always retain our intellects and our ability to judge the evidence, and we should be prepared to change our minds. We shouldn't be wedded to being liberal or conservative or whatever the particular flavor or tag of the day is, just because we want to be part of the pack. If you want to be part of the pack, you know, you've come to the wrong show. This is a show, the Ian Wishart show, is a show for independent thinkers, and I think the Vinnie Eastwood show probably is as well.
Yeah, totally. I was talking about my demographics. I was looking through them, Ian, and turns out, I'm 29 years old. My average listener is between the age of 40 and 62. Right? These are people who have gone through their life. They have worked, and they have come to this conclusion on their own. And many of them have not, at any one point, swallowed the propaganda and the mind control that the system puts upon them. And I think many of them have been waiting for this day that shows like ours can even exist, because previously there was no other real options. I mean, thank God for the internet. You know, I don't think God invented it, but still.
That's right. I mean, it is. It's really important in this independent. But again, people need to support it. They need to listen. They need to be prepared to tick the boxes and say, yeah, we do listen. We do support this. We see the need for this sort of independent media coverage of things, because the mainstream media are doing a shocking job. Sadly, so many people believe the mainstream media, and I was part of the mainstream media. That was how I made my daily bread. But I was never dumb enough to sit there and think that my fellow journalists were doing, you know, the absolute best job they possibly could. I mean, they're good, honest people, but they're still people with a perspective. And if they've been brought up in a particular way, if they've been educated in a particular way, if they've been taught to be journalists in a particular way, that will filter through, and that's what you're seeing. I mentioned a moment ago about people being blinded to what's coming to them. You know, these are not the droids you're looking for. There's so much an element of that in our media coverage these days, particularly our TV coverage. The reporters are prepared to take the words of officials at face value, and they'd have no questioning of them. I remember at the end of the Winebox court appeal process, Court of Appeal came out and basically overturned the Winebox inquiry judgment and said, you know, these transactions were fraud and there is room for prosecution. And I remember Bill Birch, who was treasurer at the time, being interviewed on News Talk ZB. And he was interviewed and he said to them, oh, this court judgment's a load of rubbish and blah, blah, blah. And there was no attempt in the ZB interview to challenge Bill Birch on any of the mistaken comments that he was making. So he was actually, you know, incorrectly stating the facts as he gave this interview. And I rang up ZB and I spoke to the reporter concerned. I said, why didn't you challenge him? And he said, oh, I'm just a reporter. I'm not allowed to question these people. What? Hello? That's what we're here for.
What's the job description? What's the job description? It's to ask questions.
Exactly.
Nothing for mercy.
So no, that's the problem we face.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, have you ever said two very ironic things in a row? You know, like one of the people in this Kiwi Journalist Association said, "Finny, you're a conspiracy nutter." Crackpot alert in full capitals, and then accused me of insulting people using ad hominem attacks and trolling. Like, I'm not sure which came first.
Good, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I love screenshotting stuff like that. You know, it's brilliant. I've got folders on my computer just full of this insane abuse. I don't know why I keep collecting it. Maybe it just amuses me. You know, like Or maybe I have some kind of sick fascination, like the way an African warlord would collect trophies of his kill or something of that nature. I don't know. But still.
Exactly. Maybe you'll be stuffed and mounted and put on your own wall.
Well, I don't think my wall's big enough, but, you know, I'm 6'4", Ian, you know.
Sprig of parsley and an apple in your mouth.
You know, I'm just born to not fit into this world. I'm sorry. In fact, we had a realization the other day, how some people find it actually really difficult to say certain things. They find it really difficult to speak up in a crowd. They find it difficult to apologize or admit that they're wrong or anything. I really don't have any of that. You know, I mean, for me to say sorry is just as easy for me to say hi to somebody. You know, it's like, hi, I'm Vinny, and I'm sorry.
Shall I share with you some of the tastier bits of Totalitaria when we come back?
I think we will.
I've just got to take a quick break, and we'll be back soon.